there, post-show recaps listeners. Hello to all my pogues, my kooks, and everyone like me who is way too afraid to get into a high-speed boat chase. I'm Mary Kwiatkowski, and I am here to break down everything that happened in the first two seasons of yet another Netflix series, Outer Banks. Joining me is the wonderful Asia Welch. Asia, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing lovely. And, you know, these pogues make it seem like such the lifestyle to be able to jump on a boat and go anywhere I please. So I'm kind of envious that they grew up in Outer Banks.
At least this version of Outer Banks.
Right.
We'll get into it. Also joining us here is the fantastic Sarah Carradine. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Good morning from the place we now call Sydney, Australia. This is the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and it was never ceded. Yes, I didn't choose the pogue life. The pogue life chose me.
Oh, man. I wish that I could say that I was really a pogue at heart, but mostly watching the show, it gives me anxiety to think about just, you know, all of the open wounds and the dirty clothing. I can't even count the number of times that I said, get these people some new clothes while watching this and some proper medical equipment. But we'll get into all of it. For those of you who haven't been sucked into the steamy and action-filled OBX universe, we are going to do a quick breakdown of the show, just like a synopsis, general thoughts, and talk about it a little bit with no spoilers, just in case you are interested in what it's all about and maybe want to go watch it yourself. And then we'll break down a more spoiler-filled section, which we'll get to. But let's just start off Outer Banks. This show, oh my gosh, you know, it's billed as an action adventure mystery teen drama, which I would say is like, let's just throw every single thing at this. The teen drama part was not what pulled me in. The sort of treasure hunt mystery portion is what really got me invested in the show. What about both of you? What do you think about the overall sort of genre and concept?
I would say I initially thought it was the real life action version of Rocket Power. So
yes.
That's kind of what I went into it thinking. And so I'm not going to lie. This was one of those shows that I had my phone in hand while I watched the first few episodes. And it wasn't until episode 5 of season 1 that I was like, oh my gosh, this is a show. So I realized there were way more things going on, way more than just the simple teen drama. Like you said, the treasure hunting, the mystery of it all. And that's when I was really sucked in. I love that it had way more going on than like your typical Netflix teen drama.
What about you, Sarah? How did you get into the show?
Well, I got into the show from the adventure treasure hunt side of it. Because when I was a young girl last century, having a childhood in the 60s and early 70s, we had children's books that were written in the 40s and 50s, and they were very much this adventure style. First thing you do is you get a group of children of some kind, you get rid of the parents in some way. They may be dead, they may be absent, they may be in India, and you put them into an adventure. So I think particularly of Swallows and Amazons, which I absolutely loved, which was a group of children in the Lake District in England. They had a boat that they would take into the lake. They found an island, but against them were a group of girls. And that made me very excited because the girls were often in these stories providing sandwiches and telling people to tuck their shirts in. So it was wonderful to get these Amazon girls that were very free and wild. But also we see it in Pippi Longstocking. I loved her. She was completely unfettered and marvelous. Goes through to Scooby-Doo, goes through to Buffy. I love the group of children get together and try and solve a mystery while being constantly thwarted by adults.
Yeah, I love that as well. The main concept here is a tight-knit group of teenagers from... Wikipedia says like the wrong side of the tracks. I don't know if I really agree with that, but there's definitely some class warfare going on between the Pogues,
are
the, you know, the lower class, sort of more rugged teenagers from the area in the Outer Banks that they're calling the Cut, versus the Kooks, or the, you know, rich kids and rich families who live in Figure 8, which is a really nice neighborhood in the Outer Banks. They talk about it as like the kind of place where you either have two houses or two jobs. And those two different groups of people are really at odds here on the Outer Banks. And part of it is always like, let's just hang out and have fun. There's a lot of partying. There's a lot of riding around at night and doing whatever you want and it feeling like summertime all the time. And then there's this really dark side of just nobody getting along, a lot of adults and other people in the higher class section who just don't believe any of the children, really a lot of horrible abusive behavior by parents to their children, you know, different teenagers against each other. But all of this is like the setting for a murder mystery treasure hunt that's going to happen. This whole thing starts off when the main character's father goes missing. And that's really the setup for season one. And season one mostly centers around a treasure hunt. And then season two follows after the very dramatic ending of season one, but no spoilers yet. So in general, I like the idea of the show, but the thing that pulled me in the most was the style just looked very different than everything else that I had been watching. When I compare it to, well, obviously very different than reality TV, but when I compare it to some other shows, it's much less polished. They really take the title of Outer Banks and run with that outdoorsy location setting. And I know this might sound different because we're normally watching Survivor, but it's a very different style of like island living, right? They really don't get afraid of showing the scope of outside, and almost every building, I think, at every location set is partially outside. The windows are open, the doors are open, nothing really feels very enclosed. And so it's a very like freeing show to watch. It's very yellow hues, and I don't know why, but the look of the show is what pulled me in more than anything else.
Yeah, I really like how it's one of those shows where you feel like you're there. And I know that's really hard to capture a lot of the times, but you do truly feel like you are there in the Outer Banks with them. I'm sure there's a specific type of camera term for how it was shot, but I love that it just wasn't your standard, hey, this is where you are, but no, we are outside. And like you said, I didn't even realize that until you said it, but yeah, every location you felt like you were partially outside. And so you truly could relate to these kids and how they were living life. And I mean, the lack of showers, it seemed, and just how they were just having a great time in those fun moments.
For sure.
The camera work is very moving, very flowing. There are very few setup static shots. There's a lot of, I would imagine, Steadicam, crane work, all that sort of stuff. I'm not technically minded, but I did notice too, like you, that the camera work is very flowing. So if we run down to a dock and we jump into a boat and then the boat goes and then the boat takes off down the water, it's all one shot. There's not a lot of cuts there. And that really gives you that freeing idea that you're just going to run, you're going to jump into a boat, you're going to whisk off. So there's a lot of freedom. There's freedom to not wear a lot of shirts. Our main character is apparently allergic to the fabric of a shirt. And then that contrasts when we do go inside, and we're often compelled to be inside. When I say we, I mean the children, teenagers, who we are immediately identifying with. We're compelled to be inside. We're told to be inside. We're not allowed to leave. And in some extreme cases, we're locked into rooms or we're trapped in a small place. And this is a fantastic contrast visually and also in terms of the plot, with that sort of free flow of you can run anywhere. You can just run and jump on your dirt bike and take off. You can run and jump on your surfboard and take off, so that we really feel that restriction that that our main characters feel when they're compelled to be inside.
Yeah, to add to that, the amount of running in season one and two, just like the adrenaline, it gets you going, because you realize, oh my gosh, they are running everywhere. And so it was a lot to handle. It's not a casual viewing experience by any means.
These characters definitely have way more energy than I did as a child, a teenager, or even now. I noticed the running. I noticed that they have very few moments where they can really sleep. It always seems like every time they're about to relax or sleep, something big happens and they have to start running and moving again. There's so many chase scenes, so many fight scenes, so much adrenaline going on. It's a show that really paces its episodes well, to where every episode almost ends on either a big reveal or a cliffhanger. So far, both seasons have done the same in different ways, but they both ended pretty impactfully. I also noticed this time around that the acting, which is something that sadly I think we usually only notice in shows, especially Netflix shows, when it's very bad, I was very impressed with it on the basis of almost every character really feels like they're real. Like, I wonder what the scripts look like through this. Particular characters, especially JJ, it seems like almost everything that comes out of his mouth feels like improv or like something that the character might actually say. There's a lot of sort of background conversations and scenes or scenes where the kids are sort of joking around and bantering and kind of get cut off. And a lot of even just in the acting of the chase scenes, the running, a lot of slipping, falling, pretty big action moments too. I wonder how they trained for some of these scenes and stunts and things like that they were doing. There's quite a lot of that.
I'm sure we'll get in more detail with the various characters, but JJ is an absolute standout. This young man, Rudy Pankow is his name. He's one of the youngest of the cast. The cast, spoiler alert, are not actually 16 years old as their characters are. However, I think you go into a show like this and you just believe it. You just say, okay, you say you're 16, then I believe you're 16. Otherwise, nothing else is going to be believable. But this young man, Rudy, is fabulous. And as you say, he's always alive in a scene, even if he's in the background. There's a moment in the second season where he has to run and do something and he actually trips and falls over something. Whether that was a moment that he put in himself, whether it was set or not, it didn't have a plot point. He didn't have to fall over when he was on the way running somewhere, but this seemed very this character, this kind of wound up character that's either so tight that he's squinching his mouth closed and being very, very put upon, or he's just running in this joyful freedom. And I liked all the actors in this, but he was a standout for me.
I noticed that exact moment where he trips and falls, and I was thinking, that was when I thought about the acting, and I thought, wow, that looks like it might not have been intentional, but he pulls it off very well.
Yeah, I will say that, you know, thinking of how, you know, if it was a lot of improv or not, there are those Netflix shows where you can obviously tell that the script is loose. Like, okay, just talk about this. Because those have I can't think of the show that I'm thinking of, but it's like 30-minute episodes and each episode stands alone. But with this, it's such an intentional plot and everything seems to have a purpose. So I think it's definitely just those moments of like, okay, in the car, this is the line, but then add to it, because we see on like Instagram and things like that, these actors are actual friends and some of them even in relationships. And so I think that, you know, I think they did a really great job of balancing that out and like keeping the purpose there, because everything had a purpose. Every little look had a purpose. But then they still had those elements of realness. I think they're just amazing actors all around.
The adult cast is also impressive. And again, we'll probably get to it. But there are some pretty heavy hitters in terms of people with a long resume. And again, I have my favorite. She is fabulous. It's Adina Porter, who you may know from American Horror Story. She was also in True Blood. And in a show where things are pretty black and white, you're good, you're bad, you're a pogue, you're a kook, you've got money, you don't have money, you have freedom, you don't have freedom. She and one of the other characters do have a little bit more ambiguity. She doesn't look like she's in a different show. She looks like she's in the same show as they all are. So it's not that she stands out in that way, but she has a gravitas and she has an ambiguity about her that is so compelling. And I find that with her acting, she always just draws me into the screen to her. She's not the only one in the adult cast. And when I say adult cast, I mean adult characters. I think it's universally welcome. But she, for me, is a standout.
So in order for us to get into this a little bit more, let's go ahead and say, if you haven't seen this show yet, but you think that you might want to, do we recommend it or not before we get into our spoiler section? I personally think that it's a show that, at least for me, took, I think like Asia said, I was kind of interested looking at my phone a little bit, but by about episode 5 in the first season, I was really hooked. I had finally fully gotten into the mystery element of it. And it's where kind of the setup took a little bit of a turn. I think that the first episode, the opening, really makes you think that the entire show is going to be about the Pogues versus the Kooks and just the teenagers getting into fights and things like that. But once it finally turned into, no, this is an action murder mystery, that's where I really got into it. So it kind of depends what you're looking for. If you're looking for teen drama, there's definitely still a fair amount of that, and they continue and add to it in season 2. But there's a lot of that. But I say, if you're interested in something that's a high action show that really makes you feel involved and interested and a little bit uncomfortable at times, especially with particular characters and scenes, not in a like Game of Thrones uncomfortable way, but for me, I was more like on the edge of my seat, nervous for the characters, if that makes sense, then I find it to be very compelling. What about both of you?
Yeah, I would highly recommend it for anyone who is curious about the show, because when I watched the first four episodes back in 2020, I took a break. I watched the first four. I was like, okay, this seems like an intense treasure hunt, but I'm not all drawn in. And then my mom was like, oh my gosh, have you seen Outer Banks? So I was like, yeah, I started it. And she's like, no, you need to go back and finish it. It is so good. And so then it was really episode five that I realized, okay, this is a show. This is an actually interesting show. It's not your typical teen show, which is what I went into it thinking. And the preview did it no justice. And I think it's because you can't do a preview for this type of show without giving a lot away, because there are definitely those awe factors all throughout, especially all throughout season two. But then definitely in the later half of season one, you're definitely going to end some episodes with your jaw on the ground. So if you're looking for a good show, and I was able to knock out, two seasons in a weekend, because I rewatched season one in preparation for this, which I was so glad I did, so that I could really capture those, or I could really understand and remember what happened in the earlier part of season one, I definitely recommend.
And since Asia and I basically said the same thing, I do want to clarify, the two seasons each have 10 episodes apiece, but it's not that the first four episodes, I think, are like boring or take a long time to get into. It's just that they really pick up in the middle. And I would say it's the kind of show where when I finished the first season, I went back and rewatched the first couple episodes of the season, and it had more of an impact on me that time around.
Same. Absolutely.
So they're all important. They do a lot of setup for in the first couple episodes, but it just really takes off and then becomes more impactful later.
And I would say, yes, I would recommend this as long as you can remember what it was like when you were 16, that everything was really dramatic, that you completely romanticized yourself and your situation. I mean, there's a lot of things that you need to let your mind slide over in terms of logic. If you can put up with people not telling each other their plan, I've got a plan. I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm just going to say, go with me, follow my lead, not actually tell you the plan. But I love all of that. And I love the pace of it is so fantastic. So don't come to this show with an overly big frowny face and a critical mind. Come to it and bring your teenage self with you, and you will be completely enraptured by it, I think.
Yes, definitely. So three thumbs up from us over here. What are you waiting on? Go watch it and then come back so that you can compare your thoughts with ours. And we're going to proceed to talk about all the things that we do and don't like. Heavy spoilers ahead from this point forward. Okay. So not only is this a show that I do like, I think it's a show that tells me and teaches me that you don't have to enjoy everything that's happening in a show for it to be compelling and to be something that's good. I think sometimes we mistake, like, a show has to make you feel good at all times in order to be good. All the characters have to be good people or be likable. And there are so many characters that are not likable in this. So let's go ahead and talk about the characters in general. And I think, Sarah, you had mentioned the actress who plays Sheriff Peterkin.
Adina Porter, yes.
Yes. I really enjoy that character and a couple other ones. There's going to be the deputy Shoop, played by Colin Moss. I would say my other sort of favorite of the adult characters is the actor who plays Pope's dad. E. Roger Mitchell is his name. They were really, to me, like the realism of the show. I think Kiara's parents also come in as being a bit of a realism factor every time they go back home and their parents are like, yeah, you can't just run away. You can't just leave the house all the time. And yeah. I love that, especially in the first season. I would say the second season, I was afraid we were going to go in a different direction with Deputy Sheriff Shoop, but luckily he ends up turning it around partway through there. I was really afraid that we were going to have a classic sort of rich guy pays off a person in a political position. So glad we didn't go down that road. But for me, of course, Charles Easton as Ward Cameron.
Oh,
I mean,
the absolute worst.
One of the so worst good. Characters, but played in the absolute best way. And for me, this was a shocker because I know Charles Easton mostly as Chip from the Whose Line Is It Anyway fame was like my main experience with him growing up. And then, of course, he had a smaller role on The Office for a while. So I've almost always seen him in comedic roles. And this is anything but comedic.
He was also in Nashville, if you watched that.
Yes, as well.
He is, he also, the ambiguity that I was praising with Adina Porter in the Sheriff Peterkin role, and also the deputy Shoup role, where you see that he does consider being bribed. It's not that he is so good that he couldn't possibly be bribed. We see that he considers it, and he considers what his life would be like. But Charles Easton as Ward absolutely embodies that ambiguity until the layers are drawn away and we see him for who he is. And we see that he was that person all along. We just weren't looking correctly. And that's just so magnificent.
Yeah, this is one of those roles that it's like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to see him again in another as another character and not think of Ward Cameron, because he committed. He played this so well that I had to Google him to see what he played in other things, because he seemed like he was made to play Ward Cameron.
Yes. So if you, for some reason, are listening to this and don't know the overview of the show, Ward Cameron, I'm going to put him as the main villain. There's a couple other antagonists throughout, but really when it comes down to it, every horrible situation that happens stems from a choice that Ward made at one point. And the first season, for me, the part when the mystery really started to unfold was when you realize that Ward Cameron was responsible for John B.'s father, Big John, his death, and that he has been missing out at sea, and that Ward was the reason, and really just the worst greedy character, feels very entitled to taking whatever is not his, and then, of course, made more complicated by the fact that he is Sarah Cameron's father, who is in a mostly on-again relationship with John B. throughout this. They tried to do the off-again part there, but it really was not the most suspenseful. I felt like, you guys have been through too much, you're going to get back together. So it all worked out for them so far.
Yeah, I actually wasn't so sure. I felt like they would get back together, but then it was one of those things where I was with Sarah, you know, later in season two. It was like, too much has happened. I don't think how do you get past that? But then I had a reality check that they're 16, and you know, at that age, I guess love conquers all. And so they're able to move past these things.
I think that is an interesting part of the show, that they do stupid things constantly, but they do things that would make stupid things that would make sense to the teenage brain. And I think this is where the creators, Josh and Jonas Pate and Shannon Burke, have really keyed in to their material, because even as we're going, no, 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 don't do that, or yes, go to the police, turn yourself in, or tell an adult, these are not things that a teenage brain tells itself. All the things that they do, logical or otherwise, stupid or otherwise, are completely understandable if you remember that they're 16. And I think this is one of the real surprising, sort of underground but surprising positives of the show, is that, I mean, obviously for plot reasons they have to do stupid things, but they're also completely justified if you remember that the teenage brain is not necessarily looking at consequences.
Yes, and I think this is an area where some teen shows really drop the ball in terms of script. And you think about the shows that just have so many laughable, cringy lines and things that people would never really say. I found the moments where I was, like you, yelling at the character or saying, oh my gosh, I can't believe you said that, this is so cringy, it also made me think, yes, but they are 16, and this is the way that a 16-year-old brain might think. You're going to yell at your parents and tell them that they don't understand. You're going to hate any form of authority. You're going to think that the most important thing at any moment is your relationship above all else. And the part where some of the logic breaks down a little is especially surrounding Sarah, when there are so many more immediate threats to like your physical safety. You don't need to be thinking about anything other than that. And so that's complicated for me, which takes me to possibly my most hated TV character since, I don't know, Joffrey Baratheon in Game of Thrones. Rafe Cameron is the worst person ever. And in season one, it really seemed like they were just saying, oh, he's just a bad guy. Potentially, this is made worse by some of his drug problems and his drinking. And then season two, I think they start to say, no, this is an actual potentially psychological problem that Rafe has. And at first I was thinking, how did this happen? But I think you see by the end of season two, there's a lot of Ward in him as well, or vice versa. And that they both have just, I don't know. I mean, like evil to them in a way that I'm not used to seeing in these teen shows, and in a very like real and scary and unnerving way, more so than just some shows that say, oh, well, they're a bad guy because they're the bad guy. These people have a motivation and you can sort of see how they got there in their mind. But also as a hopefully more balanced, logical person, you would not jump to those same conclusions. So Rafe, who really starts to get scary when talking about, you know, seeming to have some thrill from killing people, some just really not understanding the danger that he's putting himself and his family in, and of course his multiple murder attempts on his own sister.
Right. This is such a fantastic character. In fact, you know, both of the main kook teens, Topher, Sarah's ex-boyfriend, and Rafe, her brother, I think these are both initially just these rich frat boys who own the world. And we see the damage that the kook life has done to both of them. One of them manages to turn around and redeem himself because he's had a blow to his ego. He gets angry, but then rather than getting angry, he changes, which is Topher, which is very interesting in the second season. And I didn't see that coming. And I think that's really beautifully written. But Rafe, the actor Drew Starkey, is one of the older of the, let's say, the teens. And I think it could be such a scenery chewing role. And he certainly is quite extreme. But I like that both the show creators and the writers and the actor himself have given him a reason to be awful. It's a strange, he clearly has some mental health issues fueled by cocaine and by being the son of a terrible man who has instilled in him certain thoughts that his brain has twisted into justifications for the actions that he takes. So I think this is so interesting. It's much more complex than I would have expected a simple teen drama to have as the nasty older brother. It's much more interesting than that would seem at first.
Yeah, Rafe really grinded my gears. I mean, and when they, in the second season, when they tried to get into, okay, there's, you know, you had Rose, his stepmom, constantly saying, like, I think there's something seriously wrong with him in terms of saying, oh, I think he might have mental health issues. I thought that they might have identified it, or that they were going to, I guess, maybe say the name for it. That could, I mean, I know we're going to get into possibly, you know, season three predictions, but I think that that probably will be explored in season three, because we still are getting a Rafe who does not understand what's going on with him, but he's motivated by the same things, quote unquote, that Ward Cameron is motivated by. Whereas Ward is saying, I'm doing everything for my family. It's like, no, you're doing everything for the love of greed and the love of money. And that is what Rafe is chasing after. You know, he doesn't even know what the value of this cross is. He just knows it's got to be worth a lot of money. I want it. Doesn't even know why he wants it. But he says he thinks he's doing it for his family because that's kind of what his dad has instilled in him, but doing it in all the wrong ways. And so you just see it really in season two. There's just no emotion behind Rafe's eyes. Like when he is trying to kill Sarah these multiple times, it's just like, this is what I gotta do. Sorry. He's a complex character for sure, but he was tough to stick with because you kind of want the best for him. You want him to get better. You want him to realize his ways. So just Topher has, you know, had such character growth in season two, but we did not see that with him.
Yeah, in fact, we do see a moment where Rafe has almost a realization that there's something wrong with him himself, goes to his father to say, you know, a classic scene, which would be, you know, I think there's something wrong. Ward should now say, yes, let's get you some help. And Ward shuts him down. So I liked that little moment that gave you how these awful people can be made.
It's also interesting that they started showing in season one and definitely heavily dove into in this season the relationship that Ward has individually with his children, and he clearly favors Sarah. I mean, that scene in the first season where Ward finally gets the gold and thinks, I need to take one person with me. I'm taking my favorite daughter, you know, my favorite child, Sarah, with me and escaping. And then, and you know, he even kicks Rafe out of the house in the first season. And when Rafe murders Sheriff Peterkin to save his father's either life or at least keep him from going to prison, that's really what gets the ball rolling toward the later part of season one. And you can tell that in Rafe's mind, he's thinking, if I do this, if I help my father, if I remove Sarah from the picture, if I teach my father that Sarah's not one of us, he will finally like me the most. He'll finally respect me. He'll finally feel like I'm part of the family. And I would say greed is definitely a part of it. His desire to be seen in a positive way in his father's eyes is another huge factor. And at the very end of season two, when Ward himself tries to kill Sarah to get her out of the picture as well, to save his own skin, is another moment that just shows how connected Ward and Rafe are in this terrifying mindset.
It's interesting, the pairs of fathers and sons that we get through all the different characters. And I like this theme, and I think they explore it very well. As John B. and his father, Big John, who he clearly idolized, and he's missing at sea. So there's the absent father, the missing father. And through his pursuit of the treasure, we also understand that he's pursuing his father. And there's JJ's relationship with his terrible father and his sort of coming to manhood in season two, when he takes the moment to help his father, knowing it'll be the last time that he sees him. And yes, and Rafe and Ward. So we get these pairs of fathers and sons that are all different, but are sort of reflecting each other.
And also Pope, who we haven't talked a ton about, but let's start here. Pope, who I think they do a great job of giving a lot more of a plot this season. I think in the first season, they had, you know, the main Pogues. We've got John B., the leader, Kiara, who's sort of the kook who turned into a Pogue and really wants more of this sort of free spirit lifestyle. JJ, who's John B.'s best friend and kind of the loose cannon of the group, I would say. In the first season especially, JJ was constantly getting on my nerves, but I really grew to love him in this season and feel for him when he really just wants and needs a family among this group. And then Pope, who from first looking at him, you would think, okay, maybe he's not on the wealthier side of things, works hard, but in a different life, I think he could get along with the kooks if he wanted to. If you know, he seems very studious, probably of the group, the least likely to want to break rules, the most cautious in the beginning. And then in this season, because a lot of the mystery is so centered around himself and his family, he really is driven much more toward the center of the plot, and we see a very different side of him in this season. And his relationship with his father, which was similar to Kiara's, kind of strained, leaving the house a lot, not being as much of the good kid that his parents would hope for. In this season, he's given a little bit more of a leeway by his father when his father realizes, like, this is a very important and family-centric quest that he's going on, and that this is something that can, you know, is the right thing to do for his family. So I found a lot of growth in Pope as a character, even if some of that was terrifying, especially the last couple episodes when he's driving the car so fast. I did not like that.
Yeah, it's funny to look at the comparisons between Pope and John B., where season one, John B. was willing to do any and everything because it was centered around figuring out what his dad had left for him. So kind of doing anything for family. But then in season two, you get this new Pope who's willing to do any and everything for his family. I mean, he crashed Key's dad's truck. He was willing to walk the rest of the way just to make it to the church to get the cross because he had made it so far and figured out so much of the mystery to get to the cross. And so I really liked to see this side of Pope because he was, I mean, you saw that he even got up from the middle of his interview to continue this treasure hunt because it meant so much to him. So it was nice to see that, you know, he was passionate about something that was bigger than himself, even though, you know, in hindsight, it's like, yeah, at that age, you should really be focused on, you know, your future. But
I mean, this is he's such an interesting character because in the first season, he's the reasonable one. He's mm-hmm. the cautious one. He's the one whose shirt is ironed. And he continually talks about the scholarship that he wants. So he's the one of the four of them that is looking to the future. Key and JJ and John B aren't really looking to any kind of future. They want to be, you know, Pogues for life and continue as they are. Pope is the one that's looking beyond, is looking further. He wants a scholarship so he can go to college. He works. He's the only one of them who we see working, works with his father. And so he has this sort of studious, good boy, reasonable role. And then it seems that in the middle of his scholarship interview, it's not just that he realized, for me, it wasn't just that he realized he needed to go and help his friends. I had an awful feeling for him that he sat there thinking that this view of his future had been a delusion, that he was a person from the cut, that he was a Pogue, that he was somebody whose future didn't include rising above and making something of himself, which is an awful expression, but you know what I mean. And from that moment where he walks out of the interview, because of the way I just felt he was being treated very patronizingly by the interview panel, they sat there looking down at him. And I think he's a sensitive boy. He felt that. So he gave up that interview in the middle of it and he walked out to help his friends. And from that moment, we see his character not change, but open up, and this recklessness comes and this passion comes and this forget about the future, we are in this now comes. And it's not like he's a different character. It's a character that has been through quite a major revolution in the middle of season two after having aimed at this scholarship all the way from the beginning.
Yeah, I look at it as like he blossomed. He really came into his own, especially on that cusp of, you know, 16, 17, 18. He's finding his voice, because I think there were many times we saw in season one where he couldn't really vocalize how he was feeling about things or express himself properly. And so we really got to see a more mature Pope. If you think of your goals at the time, what is the mature decision in the context of this show and it them being in Outer Banks and the goal at hand? I feel like he definitely matured over season two.
And then Kiara, or Key, she's interesting. I find her to be the most teenagery of them all. Like, these actors do a good job of, even though they are in their 20s, I believe almost all of them, if not all of them, they still have like a childlike kind of wonder to them in these characters. But Kiara, in almost everything she said to her parents, was like classic, I'm a misunderstood teenager, you don't understand me, my life is different. etc. Where I think her parents are just being realistic. You know, you can't just leave home for days and drive away and never come back and skip school and all of this and show valiant effort in trying to include some normalcy in school. I think they had two scenes of them in school.
Right.
And it cracked me up at one point because we haven't really talked about the plot much, but John B is going to be dead and then not dead. And then he's going to be on the run in prison, and then he just kind of like comes back to school and everyone's like, oh hey, welcome
hey
back.
Welcome back, man.
Yeah, welcome back. Yeah. No talk of what he's missed, nothing like that. So comes back to school, first day geometry exam. Right. it's great. So I do love those type of moments, the more teenagery ones. And Kiara, she's the one in the group who does get them out of a lot of situations because of her family's wealth in different ways, usually because she is stealing her her parents' you know, money or truck or whatever it might be. But she's also very brave when it comes to the group, especially when she had to go into the pipe, into the sewers.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Nerve-wracking moment.
I hated that.
I loved the conversation that happened before that when she's standing there knowing that she's going to be the one forced to do it. And they're kind of just like debating back and forth. And she's like, so how are we going to do this? oldest? Tallest? What is it going to be? And the guys just make her do it. So great moment. And, you know, in season one, she had to be the one to go into the mausoleum. And so she's always having to get herself into these situations. But great job in this season. And then, of course, the last one, JJ, who did grow on me a lot because of his emotional moments with his father. And I think instead of just season one JJ, his solution was, why don't we just grab a gun and shoot everything up? This season, his plans were at least a little bit more interesting. And my favorite probably was the plan to break John B. out of prison when he steals his cousin's ambulance.
Brilliant.
Beautiful. Just a great
Absolutely
plan.
Beautiful. It's interesting for me, Keyes is Madison Bailey. She's the youngest of the 20-year-old teenagers. She has such a great air about her. She's very light. She's very fiery. She feels the restraints of the kook life. She wants to be a pogue. She wants to be seen as a pogue. She doesn't want to be seen sexually. She wants to be seen as one of the group, not one of the boys, I don't think. She's a wonderful young woman. And the show gives her a lot of agency. She can fix a boat. She can drive a boat. She can drive a car. She can't drive a stick. But other than that, I think the show does quite well with its female characters, but could do better. So I'm thinking of Sarah, who we haven't discussed at length. Sarah, although she does have some agency, she, for me, is more of a plot furtherer and an object of desire. If I have hopes for season three, it would be to get more from her than just being the reason that other people are in their plot, you know, to save her or to thwart her.
Yeah.
My last thing with Sarah is my biggest complaint with season two, just as a viewer, was I found it pretty hard to watch the three sort of negative men in her life, her father, her brother, and her boyfriend Topper. Really a lot of manhandling of Sarah in season one by these three people who supposedly love her, grabbing her, throwing her around, tossing her into a car, locking her into a room, not listening to her. I found that to be pretty uncomfortable to watch for the whole first season. And then in the second season, it improved for a while because she was kind of out of the picture. And then when she came back, did at least her father did listen to her of not coming near her for a while. And then, of course, her father and her brother both tried to kill her. So that was not great. So it really took a turn again. But I think we're seeing some strength in the character develop that I agree in season three, hopefully will finally reach like the final evolution of Sarah Cameron. That would be great.
Yeah. And really quick on Key. I think that, you know, they pointed out at the very beginning of season one that all three of the guys had a thing for her. Like with John B. narrating, just like, yeah, we all have a thing for Kiara. And I think that her role in their friendship is constantly trying to prove that she's more than just, you know, this sex symbol that they're seeing her as. I mean, they're just 16-year-old boys and they just have eyes for her because she's an attractive young lady. And, you know, she's trying to prove that she's a valuable member of their treasure hunt, of their friendship, of their friend group. And I think that's why she has that such challenges with John B. and even with Pope in those relationships that they're trying to form with her. So I think it's really interesting because she's also trying to get to know herself. She's trying to understand herself. She's trying to just find her way. And I think that's the last thing she needs is trying to navigate a relationship within her only friends, her only friends there. So I'm really excited to see where they take her character in season three, because I think that we're slowly finding out more about her and like who she truly is, because right now I can't really tell you like who she truly is. Whereas like with some of the other characters, we've had so much character development that it's really evident. And then JJ, I mean, you know, as you already mentioned, he grew so much from just the very, very immature JJ we saw in season one to who he is in season two and being able to manage his, you know, relationship with his dad and be able to send him off and understand like, okay, if I do this, then I won't ever have to deal with this again. And the moments of finally standing up to him. So JJ was a very profound character. Not usually the type of character that I find myself interested in, but just the guy who played this role really did a great job of allowing us to really see who JJ was.
I have a theory as to who Key's real father is, which I think we're going to find out in season three.
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, gosh. I found some of the parent relationships to be a little bit confusing because they never really say, unless I missed it, the beginning of season one, like Sarah and Rafe and their younger sister, Wheezy, who I'm assuming that's not her real name, but I don't believe we've ever heard whatever her real name is.
Yeah,
they always
never.
Just call her Wheezy. So her father, Ward, is married to Rose. But do we know what happened to their mother? I don't believe that Rose is any of their mothers. So I'm not sure about that one. We don't really have that answered. And then Kiara, it seems like sometimes she says her parents, mostly she addresses her mother. Do we believe that that is not her real father? I don't think so, because she keeps saying her mother got pregnant with a Pogue, who I don't think she's referring to
her dad,
her father there. So yeah, yeah. That's also a little confusing.
This is what we hear in season two, and a little bit of a retrofit because it's the first time we hear of it in season two. But she says to her mother, just because you got pregnant by a Pogue, you know, doesn't mean that you know, I'm going to, is the sort of the idea. And her mother's husband is there. She's not referring to him, although presumably he raised her and is her father as much as anybody else. But I wondered at that being put there. And then anyway, I'll reveal my theory when we start talking about season three. Yes, Pope's parents, we do see both of them. We see his mother and we feel that they are both his parents. So at least one of them has an intact pair of parents.
Do we know what happened to JJ's mom?
That one I'm not sure of. It sounds like, I mean, JJ's father, really not a great guy. So I imagine she left. It seems like a similar scenario with John B's mother, but we don't 100% know about that. I think he mentions at the very beginning of season one, and I've rewatched that episode a few times, and every time I kind of forget, don't remember exactly what happened. A thought came back to me, but I'm pretty sure that was actually from Juno. I don't know why. I was thinking about people's mothers. I was like, oh, is she the one who always sends him a cactus? But I'm pretty sure that's actually Juno, so never mind.
I think we're told at the beginning that JJ's mother has left.
Has left, okay.
Oh, when he was younger.
Yeah, when we learn more about JJ's father, we don't blame her. Very hard to leave a child behind, but she may have had no choice. She may have been escaping a domestic violence situation. So
I would think that is highly likely.
Right.
Given everything we've seen from Luke Maybank. So season one, yeah, Ward is really even though we don't know that he's the bad guy until about halfway through the season, he's really the big bad and then continues to be throughout this season with mostly like hired goons of his, I would say, are kind of the other people who cause the most trouble. You could say that for some of the season, the sheriff and the other officers might be antagonists, but it's really more that they are just obstacles in the children's treasure hunt, more so than really bad guys. Whereas in season two, I think you're about to talk about Carla Limbray, who is really not a great person. She is some old wealth, clinging to her wealth, and all of which she has from, once we hear more about the history of the royal merchant, it seems like she is the descendant of the captain of the royal merchant, and it seems like most of the wealth from that boat was stolen from another ship. So I think what she believes is rightfully hers is also just not true. And that's some flawed logic there. And then she is also dying of something. I'm not 100% sure what it is, but she is on the brink of death, it seems like, and is looking for, and this is when the plot loses me a little bit, the magical shroud that is going to heal her. So we have moved into a little bit of a sort of mystical territory, or religiously spiritual territory. What are both of your thoughts on Carla and also that plot line?
They lost me when we finally realized why she wanted the cross was so that it could heal her. And then, I mean, what is it? She's going to be immortal? Or is it just that, you know, she's healed of her current illness and her disability because since she's on crutches? I did think it was interesting her character at first. I thought she wasn't as, I guess, not evil, but I didn't think that she was going to be a villain because it seemed like, okay, I just have a very specific ask. And once this is done, I'm done with you. But it wasn't until she killed, Renfield. And I was just like, oh no, okay, that's who she is. And then when we revisit her at the very end of season two, and we see her, I don't know if we've mentioned this yet, but Big John B's dad is alive. Then I said, okay, she's a way larger character than I initially thought. I thought she was just like, just a little disturbance to their treasure hunt. But it was very evident that no, she's a major piece of this. And I'm not quite sure if they're going to keep exploring this magical whatever it is that is supposed to cure her, or if she has some relation to Big John and John B. I'm not sure where she fits in just yet.
I like this character very much. She's very peculiar. This is Elizabeth Mitchell, who we remember as Juliet from Lost.
That's where I knew her from.
She's so familiar, and yet so she's almost transparent. She comes for me from the character from a slightly different genre. This is a Southern Gothic rather than this Scooby-Doo mystery treasure hunt. And I think that's why she is a slightly uneasy fit with the plot. I think it's a wonderful character, and I think Elizabeth Mitchell does it beautifully. It's very restrained, but it's in a slightly different genre. And as you've both said, we introduce the mystical now. She's not after the money. She wants to touch the cloth that is inside the cross. I think you have to just swallow it and move on with them, because as you say, she appears at the end and is obviously going to be woven in much more thoroughly in season two. I didn't mind it. I certainly love the denouement where the moths come out and they've obviously eaten the sacred cloth. And I like her. I like her as a little bad for the season. My thoughts of her at the end and the revelation that Big John isn't dead, I mean, no one seems to ever be dead in The Outer Banks unless you're a secondary character, was that somehow, because we know that Ward and Big John were working together on the treasure, I wonder if she is also involved in that hunt as well.
I'm definitely wondering about it. It seems like she had said that she had passed business deals with Ward and that he had at some point betrayed her as well, which seems to be par for the course when it comes to Ward and people who help him. I'm not sure why anyone would agree to help him for no matter what money, because he just seems to kill all of them anyway. I tried to do a tally and then forgot after about episode 3 of season 2, but the kill count went up a little bit for the Cameron family in this season. I think, let's see, by episode 2 I had 6, 5 of which were from season 1 in Big John, Scooter, Peterkin, and then the two men who I presume Ward had hired at some point. And then in episode 2 of the second season, he also is going to kill Gavin, who flew the plane with all the gold in it. And then there are some more murders throughout after this.
Some more to come.
Yeah.
Yes. He does a lot of accidental killing, like pushing people over and they hit their head, or, you know, it's not that he quite meant to kill them, but he doesn't care that he did.
Right. Gosh. I mean, it's like a lot of this could have been avoided if he just had taken Big John to the hospital instead of pushing him overboard once he first got injured. And of course, that's because of greed. And, you know, Ward's motivation for a lot of this is he has built his way up in wealth throughout his lifetime, but he is now in debt. And so he needs a windfall in order to make a lot of his problems go away. So we've talked a bit about the general plotline from season one. And for me, the moment when I really, really just got fully invested in the show was, I think, it was either 8 or 9 of season 1 when Sheriff Peterkin does get killed. I think that's at the very end of episode 8. And we find out, you know, we have Sheriff Peterkin finally figures out everything that's happening, knows that Ward is the bad guy all along. You go, oh my gosh, this is great. Everything's going to work out. But then you look and you realize there's 2 more episodes in the season. Yeah. And so you know it's not going to work out. And of course, Sheriff Peterkin arrives to arrest Ward, but Rafe kills her instead. And then the next 2 episodes were just nonstop stop high stakes John B. trying to flee from the island that is under major lockdown once the SBI, so what is that, State Bureau of Investigation?
Yeah, maybe.
I guess. they show up and lock down the island as well. And there's some, you know, big sort of set pieces in terms of the fact that the whole first season is set during a power outage from a hurricane. And so some really great moments there. And of course, the season one climax ends with the fact that everybody thinks that John B. and Sarah have died by taking the boat to try and escape through a huge storm, and they end up shipwrecked. But somehow, while they're shipwrecked, able to cling on to the hunk of gold that they still have and then get picked up by a fishing boat. So that really wraps up season one. And then we move into season two, where at least we, the audience, know that they're alive, but everyone back at the Outer Banks does not. So this season two is kind of split into a couple different chunks. I'd say the first chunk is the John B. and Sarah in the Bahamas trying to get back home and trying to survive there while also still trying to get the gold that they found in season one. And then the second chunk of the season is more on this new quest and new heist in mystery.
Yeah, with going into season two, I was really impressed with the fact that it picked up at the moment that season one ended. There was no lack in time. I was like, they're very lucky these characters are in their 20s because you can tell no one has aged. And so it was very great from a continuity perspective. But when the Pogues find out that John B. is still alive, I literally got chills because they were the pure happiness that their friend that they thought they were going to have to, or that they had already started grieving, was alive. That was just beautiful to me. And I know we'll get into it, but I really wanted John B. and Sarah to stay in the Bahamas a little bit longer for the pure fact that Cleo was there.
Yes, Cleo.
Yes, Cleo.
As we are luckily going to end up finding out that yes. Cleo is going to return in the final episode of the season, which I will say my sister downstairs while I was watching this came running to the foot of the stairs because I screamed out loud yes. when Cleo showed up again in episode 10 and presumably is going to be a little bit more part of this group moving forward. Mm-hmm. But this character of really just like the epitome of badass takes care of herself.
Yes.
Woman. She's got great, like, I don't know, people skills, street smarts, right? Able to get all the children to help them in their heist. Mm-hmm. She is savvy enough to save herself while also human enough to not just be a brutal killer like the other people that she seems to be working with. She, you know, is wise and says, don't trust fully. What is Captain Terrence, I believe, was the captain of the boat that John B. and Sarah get on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Cleo is great. Really glad that we found her here. I guess more about this, the Bahamas plot line. Sarah, what were your thoughts on the first couple episodes?
Well, it's interesting because we find out that the boat that has picked up John B. and Sarah clinging to a piece of gold and some wreckage in the middle of the sea, they're smugglers. And so this is one of the reasons why when they find out, this crew of smugglers find out that John B. has a price on his head, they're not going to call the authorities yet because of the contraband that is on their boat. And the interesting thing here with Captain Terrence and Cleo, we get a little bit of her backstory where she was an orphan and he raised her. So he's another father-child relationship, but a completely different one where it's a sort of adoptive relationship. And she obviously has a fierce loyalty to him, but also is completely aware of how trustworthy he is, which is not at all. I love this crew. I loved the Bahamas when John B. and Sarah get there and they feel a great sense of freedom, but it's a place they don't belong. And I think the show is really good at showing us this sort of visually and also in small scenes. They don't belong there. They don't belong at the posh hotel that they managed to break into. They don't belong. It's at Sarah's family house is now a place where she doesn't belong. And they also don't belong on the streets with the smugglers either. So I think for me, one of the themes of season two, and Asia, you touched on that, is they are these children, these teenagers are becoming who they are. And one of the ways that you become who you are is finding out who you're not. I don't know that it's not a huge punch you in the face theme, but this is why I love the scenes in the Bahamas, because they were a nation of two, sort of adrift in this land they didn't belong in.
P for L, right?
P for L.
Which I don't think was something, at least I don't remember them saying P for L at all in season one, but they were really trying to drive that point home in season two.
Right.
Bit of a retrofit. They carve it into a tree when they think John B's dead, and JJ carves it into his arm. It's like, oh, okay, so we get it.
Okay, great. Yeah, the gold heist itself, where they enlist the help of Captain Terrence and I can't remember the other smuggler's name. That's escaping me.
Neither can he, because he keeps banging his head on the on things. It's a very tall man.
Yes. Yes, I can't. I'm completely not able to find his name even when I'm looking for it here. But the three of them help out Sarah and John B. And there is a really tense moment where Ward and Rafe have their heads on the ground held at gunpoint while Sarah and John B. are trying to steal the truck with the gold. And Rafe ends up shooting Sarah. But just the look on Ward's face when he realizes that his daughter is alive, I thought was a really powerful moment, because like you said, nobody is dead for good unless you are a secondary character.
Right.
But certainly if you have the last name Cameron, you're not going to die in this show, it seems like. And that was a pretty tense moment with Sarah getting shot. She seemed to sort of not even realize it at first, and then it goes from about 1 to 100 really fast.
Yeah.
So that was a really intense episode as well, with the doctor that they take her to.
the not doctor.
Right.
Not doctor. Yeah. I thought perhaps he was a veterinarian, but he does say when you find the cure for arthritis at medical school, they don't let you get your medical degree. And I thought, yes, I'm sure that's why.
Right. So, yeah, when Sarah was shot, she was definitely in shock. And when the shooting happened, I was thinking there's no way neither one of them was hit, because they weren't that far away. I mean, they were a good, 20 meters or so. And so when, you know, she did realize it, I was just thinking there's no way they're going to kill her off, until she was on the operating table and they got me. And I was thinking, well, this might be it. John B might be going back alone. But of course, she's a Cameron, so she lives. But Rafe knew very well that he hit her. He knew. And there was no remorse, no compassion, no regret. And that's when I really knew, like, who Rafe is. There's no point of return unless he is gets help, professional help.
Yes. And that was a little bit of a almost continuity moment for me, where you see Ward is just so thrilled to find out that Sarah's alive. But at the point when his son says that he shot her intentionally, Ward does not seem to, you know, he searches the hospitals and morgues, he said, to see if she turned up there. But when she doesn't, he's like, okay, well, I guess I'll just go back home then and hope she shows up again eventually. See, I would have thought that he maybe would have put a little bit more effort into that. But instead, he's putting a lot more effort into the gold situation. So really just shows you where his priorities are.
His terror at losing his position. He's built himself up. He's built up money. We don't know how, but he's lost it all. And he now needs a huge windfall. This is why he went into a partnership, he thought, with Big John. The reason that he attacks and thinks he's killed Big John is because he was being offered a less than 50-50 cut. It's greed and it is position. I mean, you can see when he threatens the deputy Shoup, who is the interim sheriff after Peterkin dies, and says to him, if you want that interim gone, you'll do this and that for me. He's used to that easy leadership of other men, that he's addic- connected to the praise of society as much as the money. And it's his terror at losing that that trumps even his idea of family. And I think the family for him is just a symbol of his position rather than actual love.
So once Sarah and John B. do manage to get back to North Carolina, unfortunately, sans gold, but they do manage to get back alive, which is really the important part. And then coincidence of all coincidences, literally run headlong into Key and Pope and JJ. So they're all back together again, which is great. And I think you see a little bit of how they realize that maybe this Pogue life is a little harder than we thought outside of our home area, because they're just constantly having to sort of run around, sneak around, steal money, steal food, that sort of thing. So they go back home, and that's where we have been recently introduced to this new plot line, which is there is a key that Limbry wants, and that key is going to unlock a cross, which they also need to find, that was, I believe, on the same ship as the original gold, but had been taken onto the Royal Merchant. And then Denmark Tanny, who managed to get away from the shipwreck, from the hurricane, got the cross off, got the gold. We knew that he buried the gold or hid it in the well from season one. And then the cross, which we're later going to find, he hid inside the church that he built in this season. So there's a lot of exploring that. I thought it was pretty obvious, pretty much from the moment when Limbry hunts down Pope and gets him to come to her house, that we realize he's got to be blood relative of Denmark Tanny some way or another. It seemed a little bit obvious.
I thought that was obvious too. I was so confused when he was talking to his meemaw and she told him, and he was shocked. I was like, was that supposed to be Pope? The reveal?
Put two and catch two up.
Catch up, because it was so obvious that it's like he talked to his dad. He's like, okay, you need to talk to this person. You need to talk to this person. So I thought that was a little delayed, because I was like, oh, we weren't already told, but I guess I had assumed.
Yeah. And I do like that has led into his more leadership role here, his real desire that this is something that belongs to his family, and that they really need to get a win against the Camerons, who just seem to be constantly getting away with everything. Like, these children do all the legwork for Ward in terms of finding all of the hidden treasure for Ward and Rafe and Limbry, and then they're not quite closers, and some of that is done in this sort of eye-rolly teenage way where I just constantly yell, what kind of plan is this? This is the dumbest plan ever, because their plans are things like, oh, we'll just go get the gold.
Yeah.
And then do what with it? Like, you have no ability to sell it or to trade it or anything. They tried that once in the first season, and with, oh my gosh, another one of my least favorite characters, Barry, the drug dealer.
Oh my gosh,
just around, and he redeemed himself very slightly when he sold Rafe over to the sheriff. But
yes,
I love Barry. I must disagree. We've been agreeing all along, but I must disagree. I love Barry. I think he's a great character. I think he's the sort of epitome of the Pogue life. He is the successful moneyed Pogue, successful in inverted commas, obviously, because what he does is against the law. But he has he's presumably sort of the same age as Rafe, or a little older. I'm assuming he's supposed to be, you know, in his early 20s, the character, I mean. And I was very fond of him because he's very practical, and it's all completely business, and there's no emotion in his dealings with people. And they're the ones that are ripping him off, and they're the ones that aren't paying him. And he's the only one that Rafe seems to be afraid of, so that made me like him a lot. And then, of course, that wonderful moment where he jumps out of the boat that he's in with Rafe and shouts, he's armed, and then we see all the police descend on Rafe, and it's very satisfying.
Yeah, a few more moments that I liked of him in this season. I think season one, he was just constantly showing up with a gun and threatening people, and that was frustrating for me because he was just another one of the sort of mini bads. But this season, like, at the moment where Rafe decides that he hears Kiara in the drain and he's going to put the water down there anyway, Barry's like, okay, yeah, I'm going to peace out. This has gotten a little too dark for me. So bye. I'm not going to be around for when this goes down.
Beyond my typical level of crime, this is next right. level.
Yes. I mean, he's more of the kind of like all talk, no action. Sure, he'll get into a scrap now and then, but he's not going to like actively just try to kill people in broad daylight in the same way that Rafe might. So
yeah, he's the where's my money guy? Yeah. Where's my right. money?
Right. So we have that whole situation. When John B comes back, we're going to have a really short moment of him being on the run and then eventually getting arrested. But up until this point, the other Pogues have really found what I would consider to be, at the very least, quite substantial evidence that John B is innocent and that Ward slash Rafe are the real criminals here. And this is when I was getting nervous that Deputy Shoup was going to, or Interim Sheriff Shoup was going to turn full bad, but he ends up coming back to the light. And, you know, when you really think about it, it's like, yeah, obviously. I think the moment at the end of season one where John B calls on the boat radio and says, "You ruined my life, you murdered my father and framed me for a crime I didn't commit." At that point, I would think anybody listening, and I believe that the SBI was there at that time,
yeah,
should think a little bit about who's the one with the real means and the real power to commit these crimes, and which one of these people is just a teenager.
Exactly. They're like treating John B. like he's this well thought out criminal. Definitely at the end of season one, I'm like, what are y'all thinking? He's just a simple guy from the cut. Like, he's not capable of all that you are making it out to be. Yeah, so you're saying the substantial evidence was the gun at the beginning of season two?
Yeah, so we've got the gun that Rafe used to kill Sheriff Peterkin, which was Ward's gun. It's registered to him. And that same gun, I think it's at the point where Gavin, you know, disappears and the kids say, "Hey, we saw Ward murder him." The gun, you know, went down the drain. At that point, if I am the sheriff, I'm going to be at the very least taking them in, taking their statement, you know, trying to put the pieces together. Once you find out that Gavin is missing, doesn't come back, I would also be even more considering that. And the fact that while they don't have the evidence of the video, which was probably one of the more eye-rolly moments where they are filming on this camera and then accidentally drop the camera, they do at least have a camera with them. So like their story does kind of check out here. I'm a little bit surprised that they didn't bother to show us, like, I don't know what kind of tape or whatever it was recording on, like even trying to salvage that. But I feel like maybe there was something there.
My roommate was in and out like the entire time I was rewatching season one and watching season two. And so she was kind of keeping up. And then when she saw them filming, she's like, "Oh, they're going to ruin that. There's absolutely no way they're going to keep that footage because that's too easy." And then later I told her, I was like, "Yeah, they dropped it in the water."
They dropped it in the cassette. What a lovely little piece of thoughtfulness in the plotting is that when the SBI gets the gun, it is that Rafe's fingerprints are on the bullets. Because Ward has said, "Oh, yes, John B. could, yes, it's my gun, but John B. was staying with us and he could have stolen it." And so I liked that little detail that it was the bullets that had Rafe's fingerprints on them. So therefore he loaded the gun. I liked that a lot.
Which you would have thought was something that these are the bullets, I presume, that were also in Sheriff Peterkin as well. Like they probably could have checked those. It just seemed like they were not really trying too hard to investigate the Camerons when they really should have been.
Are you critiquing the policing methods?
I mean, yes. And I know that John B. was not exactly the nicest to Shoup in season one, mostly just sort of making fun of him and running away from him. But there's a big difference between like obnoxious kid and cold-blooded murderer, especially when Sheriff Peterkin was one of the few people really looking out for John B. in season one.
Yeah, that reminds me of the fact that he stole Shoup's police truck. And I think that really highlights some of the things that we've touched on so far, is just that, you know, they are teenagers, so they're not thinking of the repercussions of a lot of the major things they're doing. Like, a lot of the things they're getting into is, it could be life or death. Like, death is on the line, and they do it anyway. So I think that shows, like, the level and the extent they go to find this treasure and to find the cross and to find the gold. That would wouldn't be accomplished if they weren't teenagers.
Yes. One of the repercussions here that we're going to hear about a lot is Kiara's parents threatening to send her to boarding school. And the main reason I wanted to touch on this is they're going to hand her a pamphlet towards the end of the season that just says Blue Ridge School is all it says. And I just wanted to point out the fact that I looked this up to see if there was a Blue Ridge boarding school, because I do know of one. The Blue Ridge boarding school that I know of is 5 minutes from my parents' house, where I grew up in Virginia. And it's an all boys school, though. So I don't know if they just thought, we'll just like make up a random name and see what happens. But there is actually a school. It's just not a school that Kiara would likely attend. But I thought that was an interesting moment there. Speaking of the location, we sort of touched on it overall, but the show is not actually filmed in the Outer Banks. It's, I believe, Sarah, you said that it's filmed in South Carolina. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. So I assume, Sarah, you have not been to the actual Outer Banks. Asia, have you by any chance?
I have not. No. And I did have to look up, you know, the fact that they make it seem so easy to just ride a boat to the Bahamas. I was like, where is the Outer Banks located? But I see it's a straight shot in the water from North Carolina, like in the Outer Banks to Nassau, Bahamas. But no, I haven't. I'm trying to think if I've ever even been to North Carolina. I think I've stopped there on a plane ride, like maybe stopped in Charlotte on the way to like New York or something. But yeah, I've never been to North Carolina or even South Carolina.
So I'm not sure if I think that they did possibly film some of the Charleston, South Carolina scenes in Charleston. That looks a lot like the Charleston that I visited at the very least. And Charleston is where I've left from there to take a cruise to the Bahamas and Nassau before. So I've also been to Nassau, but the Outer Banks in North Carolina, for me at least, it's the place where my living in Virginia, that's where everybody goes, like after their final week of high school, they go to beach week and you stay in the Outer Banks, which is at least that area of the Outer Banks, the very touristy sort of strip of land, does not really, really look like anything from this show. Not that there aren't parts of North Carolina that look like that, but the more touristy rental area is kind of just more of like a typical beachfront kind of situation. Not as much of the swamp land that they show it to be, but it definitely does exist, just not exactly as shown. But a lot of my relatives who live in Virginia Beach, which is by boat, you know, 5 minutes from the Outer Banks, is there are parts that kind of give me that same vibe. And that's one of the reasons I like the show a lot, is because at the very least, it's set somewhere that I presumably could have been to. Another thing I wanted to touch on real quick is, of course, since I podcast about Riverdale, I'm thinking about some of the comparisons here. And there's something in both of these shows, which is our main character dating the daughter of a man who has on multiple occasions tried to kill him. And in both of these shows, it's just like a absurd scenario. But in this show, at least, they try to cause some tension among the characters of, even though Sarah realizes that her father is a murderer and is a really evil person, she still has, you know, this relationship with her father and knowledge of the image of him that she thought he was for most of her life. And that is going to be a little bit conflicting with watching her boyfriend show some glee over her father's presumed death.
At the beginning of when we see them first, it's a I didn't like you when I first met you theme, well, very common to many, many romances. She feels she's above him. He feels she's looking down her nose at him. But of course, that because they're meant to be, we believe that they're together. I think that the show was very lucky with the chemistry between the two actors, because I don't know, certainly in the beginning, that it gives us a lot of reason to see them together or believe them together. But certainly the chemistry between the actors gives us that spark. And she has just had we see her break up with her perfectly reasonable boyfriend, and in fact start to explore her sexuality with him, but stop him because she didn't feel anything. So we do believe in their relationship in that way, that she feels this spark with John B. And when you're 16, that spark does take you a long way. It does stretch credulity by the middle and towards the end of season two, certainly when they think that Ward's dead, as we know from this show. No one's ever dead unless you're a background goon. She watches them very tactlessly celebrate the death of her father. And here's one of the things that I like is the relationship between Key and Sarah. They're old friends turned old rivals and returned as now friends. So we get a little bit of girl power there. And yes, the moment that you've both touched on when Sarah comes and says, too much has passed. We must now part. I thought, well, I'm glad they gave us that moment because it was getting a little bit too much to take, even though we suspend our disbelief, that it would be smooth sailing for them without a bump.
Yeah, they were interesting because I wasn't sure if I should be rooting for them or not because it was so cold to hot so fast. Like you went from just despising each other, thinking that she's the one that told about the scuba gear, and then to, oh my gosh, like we should get married. So it was so quick that I thought, you know, do they even truly know who they are as people? I'm like, okay, obviously not, but they are 16. So it's just this head over heels, you know, high school or even, I mean, like on Big Brother, this middle school, like crush, this romance, this immature type of love. And so I wasn't too sure how to feel about them together. Like I didn't know if the show painted a good picture of like, this is a love story you should want, or is it just like, okay, there was so much just conflict between the Pogues and Sarah and not wanting her around. And then when she finally made up with Key, it's like, okay, but you still have this toxic family that's messing everything up. So it's like, should I be expecting something to come from you as well? You know, I kind of was always on the edge of my seat with Sarah because it was like, okay, these are your people. Do you have a hidden agenda or are you truly just like the black sheep of the family? So I was just, I was never all bought in on them for those reasons.
I still have mixed feelings on it because I also think that especially in the first couple episodes of season two, they've got this new romance where they're playing games, calling each other Vlad and Val, and everything sort of seems like this sort of fun adventure while also being very high stakes. And they both save each other's lives multiple times and go through really a lot together that I think that that's the part that made me think, oh, well, they've got to get back together because how do you save someone's life so many times and then not? But I guess I could say the same thing for Topper since he's going to save Sarah's life as well. And I was almost wondering if the show is going to do some sort of switch where it's revealed that Topper knew what Rafe was going to do and specifically tried to show up at that exact moment to save her life. But they ended up making him just sort of a better character for that. Now, at the point that we've mentioned where Ward is going to presumably die, where he does not and shows up again at the final episode, I think at the point where we see Rose booking passage and getting her family out of there and receiving a handwritten letter from a mysterious person that we don't know of at first, that was where it was pretty much confirmed to me. But I did write in my notes during episode 7, I wrote, part of me is wondering if Ward somehow didn't actually blow himself up and somehow managed to escape, because it all worked out a little too cleanly with him admitting to all of the murders, saving mm-hmm. his son from prison, and then you know, it just seemed a little bit too tidy, because I'm thinking, he has all that gold. Is he going to give up this easily?
Yeah, I didn't believe he was dead for a moment. Because when maybe I've just seen too many films or read too many books, but he was standing on the deck of his boat shouting at the SBI, I did it, it was all me, Rafe didn't do it. And I thought, yeah, that boat's going to blow up. And indeed, not to be too smarty, it did. And indeed, he was not dead. But I didn't mind that. I didn't mind the show putting me through that, because I think it does take it seriously, but there's a very slight wink where the show does bring you in on everything and brings you along with it. And I thought, yes, he's not dead, and that's fine. So when he turned up not dead, I was pleased. with myself to be so knowledgeable, but also I felt it was earned. He didn't just turn up from the dead, whereas Big John turning up from the dead, I don't think they've earned it. So I'll be very interested to see what they do in season three, but they definitely earned Ward returning from the dead.
And then what about the fact that John B does not actually kill him at the end? They get into a fight that is almost identical to the fight that Ward and Big John have, but with Ward hitting the back of his head this time, and John B could push him into the water and he would probably die, although Big John didn't actually die that way from what it seems, so who knows. And it seems like Sarah even gives him the slight nod, the slight go ahead, but I think this is really just a desire for none of our lead teenagers to be outright murderers.
Yes, yeah. I think that's absolutely right. That would be unacceptable.
Yeah, because I was literally thinking, why are you walking away from him right now? You know he's not going to die. Like, you know it. Like, you need to confirm. But then, like you said, John B is not a killer. So that just would have been completely just out of character. And then to do it in front of Sarah. So I think it was just like, okay, I got the pain that I needed to see. And he's not able to kill me in this moment. So let me just get away. So I think that they're going to be, of course, they're going to be stunned to find out that, you know, he's not dead. But it's like, what are you expecting? You didn't confirm that at all.
Yes. I'm glad, I guess, that he didn't. I'm also mostly just glad because while I detest Ward, it's exciting to have him still in the show.
Yeah.
I think for these older teen drama type shows, you need to have a adult character bad guy, but it's also important to have bad guys that are sort of their own peers. And in the first season, there was a lot more of that with Rafe and Topper and Kels. And then Kels, unfortunately, in this season is mostly seen to be just kind of an annoying teenager, more like a jerky kind of guy walking around continuing to say that John B is a murderer after Ward admits to it. So he's just kind of not really given as much a role here. And then Topper turns around a little, but still doesn't like John B, doesn't like Sarah's relationship with him, but seems a lot less personal and a lot more about Sarah and his desire to be with her. So I feel better about them. I feel bad at the end of the show, though, mostly for Kiara's parents, Pope's father.
Yes.
And I almost feel a little bit bad for Topper, too, there. I was kind of surprised that they include him in the sort of sad montage at the end. My heart really goes out to the people who are like the quote-unquote real people in this world. Hopefully they make it back home or find some way to contact their parents sooner rather than later.
This was one of the unexpected delights of the season.
Yeah.
Was we have this very romantic, idealized fire on the beach. It's dark. Our heroes are all together. We've found Cleo again. She's with us. We're all here. It's wonderful. And they're toasting fish and they're with each other and they're so happy. And it could have sort of faded out there. But no, we go back to the cut and we see Kiki's parents putting up missing persons posters. We see Pope's father, very sad. And it was a real gut punch. And I thought, oh, well done. Because we come down from our heightened romantic teenage brains and into this is the reality of what your wonderful free Pogue life is actually doing to the people around you. And I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah. And like you said, like with them including Topper, I think we got such a transformation with Topper maturing and really understanding that he truly has strong feelings for Sarah and he's been able to care for her in John B's absence. And he really does care for her. And so I think it's showing that okay, now that you kind of feel a little bit better about Topper, we should show you that this is going to affect him as well now that Sarah is gone for a second time. And, you know, with Key's parents, when we first saw that just how upset they were, it's just like, let her live. And I'm like, no, actually, that's a very real response for a parent who has a 6-year-old who is just constantly sneaking out of the house, constantly doing dangerous things. And so it's just like, at this point, they're at such a loss, they don't know what to do. And now they've completely lost their daughter. That was their biggest fear, and which is the whole reason they were trying to protect her. And so, and then, yeah, obviously seeing Pope's dad is just, especially after he had come around to the treasure and just understanding, like, yes, you're doing this for family, so I support you. It's just feel for all of their families and loved ones.
And I think this is the point where probably me, as someone who is in between the age of Kiara and her parents, I realize that what would my idealized circumstance would be, okay, Kiara, you need to understand that as a 16-year-old, you cannot continue to sneak out of the house, and you need to communicate with your family better, show up every once in a while, go to school, etc. But also as her parents, it would be great if they did try to believe in her daughter a little bit more. I think that you would hope that the teenager could go to her parents and say, you know, my friend is not a murderer. We have the means to do some things to help him in this situation. Why don't we use that power and that money and that sway for good? And instead, her parents are kind of like, ugh, just don't bother with those boys. We don't like it that you're friends with them anyway. So I want this middle ground. And yeah, of course, both sides are feel like the other one is just being unreasonable. But maybe we'll, and we started to see a little bit more of that with Pope's father in this season, of that middle ground. So hopefully we get more of that. Now, of course, I completely don't blame Kiara's parents for anything when it comes to the fact that she completely totaled their truck, and the number of cars that just get horribly beaten up in this show. Cars, boats, all of the vehicles getting stolen, lost, sunk, damaged. It cracks me up that they drive around in the Volkswagen van, the Twinkie, that they drive around in that, which just has bullet holes all through the windshield. And that was a surprisingly a cute moment when the police officer who had pretty brutally beaten up John B. when he thought that he had murdered Sheriff Peterkin ends up giving him the van back repaired. I thought that was, I mean, I don't know if that's exactly an eye for an eye, but
right. <you know. laughs>
At least
it was
he
as much
that.
As he was going to get.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The great thing about that van is that somebody can be driving it and you can slide the door open and then the rest of the gang can come running and throw themselves into the open side as the van goes. It's such a brilliant vehicle. And in amongst everything else that crashes and blows up, and they have a rickshaw bike that they steal at one point, and they have motocross bikes, everything gets blown up, stolen, sunk, crashed, but the old van just keeps going and keeps going. Even survives alligators, crocodiles, alligators. What do they have there?
I think alligators. Yes. Which was another just telling moment when you hear JJ constantly talk about how there's gators in the swamp, and then John P is attacked by a gator.
Right.
Of course.
A wonderful.
Naturally.
Moment. Yes.
Well, what about the treasure hunt itself? Like, did that make sense to you guys? Just the clues that were left along the way and how they got from one thing to the next?
So, okay, well, we start out with a key, which has been passed down in Pope's family. And then that key has an inscription on it that says something about the path to the tomb begins in the jungle room, I think is what it said.
The island room.
Island room.
And yes. It only illuminates when you pat dust into the air, then you can see the illumination of the words.
Yeah, to put a light on it and then point it to what. Yes, it's, yeah. Some of the clues are a little bit like, just say where it is. Just say where it is.
One of my favorite moments is when they're searching the church, and I believe it's either Sarah or Kiara says, this isn't an escape room.
Yeah.
We just need to find, we don't need to look for obscure clues. We just need to find the cross.
I thought that was so hilarious because I'm an escape room enthusiast. Like, I've done like 35 at this
Ooh.
Point. Yes.
Ooh.
So I died, like audibly laughed when she said, this is not an escape room. Because I'm like, yeah, back, what, hundreds of years ago when this happened, they weren't thinking, okay, in the future, 2020, they're going to come in here, they're going to look on the wall, and then a thing is going to drop down, and then they're going to do this, do that.
They're going to move a book and push a button. and a lot of treasure hunt movies go in that direction, yeah. Right? You think of like National Treasure and stuff like that. It's definitely more escape roomy. But so the island room, which this is the one that I think was the most a little bit too convenient, too coincidental, which is that Rafe is going to punch a wall in anger, yeah. And later that will reveal that there is a wallpaper hidden behind the wallpaper, or a mural hidden behind the wallpaper depicting drawings of the island by Denmark Tanny. And, you know, makes sense since it's his house.
Yeah.
that checks out. But I guess I don't know who put up the wallpaper, if that was the Camerons or a previous family or what. But yeah, that was the one that I thought was a little bit too much of a coincidence.
Yeah, it was definitely a stretch, because as soon as he punched it and he pulled his hand out, I was like, oh, there are words under there. So I knew that we were going to be revisiting that room.
I did like the clue about the real treasure is at the foot of the angel. And we find out that Denmark Tanny is talking about his wife. I thought that was lovely. And yeah. I thought that was a really thoughtful moment for the, I keep calling them children, the teenagers. They think they've solved where the treasure is, and then they find it's his wife, and then they realize what he meant by the real treasure, and they are moved by it, and they have a moment, and they rebury her very thoughtfully and delicately. And I thought that was really nice, that they're not just like, oh no, it's not what we wanted, that they in fact sort of inhabit a moment of almost adult emotion and understanding. And I liked that a lot.
Yes.
So that's going to lead them to find a telescope that tells them to go to the church where they're going to find the cross. And of course, the frustrating part of the heist here, we've said some nice things about Topper, but Topper showing up to look for Sarah and then realizing that he can check Sarah's phone and leading Rafe to where Sarah is at the church with the cross. Topper, you were doing so well.
And then conveniently, Pope getting stung by all the wasps. So, of course, they need to take care of that before they can get the cross, which in turn gives Rafe time to show up. And so I was thinking, like, okay, was Topper having Find My Friends basically on Sarah? Was that in, okay, like, I'm trying to look out for her? Or did they agree on that? Or did he sneakily was able to get her location?
Well, we do find out in season one when she, in the beginning of the breakup of Topper and Sarah, we do see him as a very controlling person. Mm-hmm. And he's asking her what phone calls she's made, who she's been talking to, where she's been. So it is very, again, it's quite earned that a person who started off with that kind of controlling behavior, although as we know he's changed, he still has the Find My Friend on the phone.
Yeah.
This is something that I appreciate about the Pogues, is that they're enjoying the treasure hunt, but the treasure hunt itself, while the gold and the glory and the riches is exciting, they are more so doing it for a bigger purpose. In season one is to find out more about John B's missing father. And in this season, it's more about Pope's, his ancestors. So that is going to result in them prioritizing, you know, sane things like the health of their their friends over the cross. So that's, you know, all in all, good for them for doing that. Although they're going to throw caution to the wind a bit in the finale. So the final episode there, of course, is going to be this big scenario on a shipping vessel where we re-meet up with Cleo. The plan to take control of the boat, which almost works, is pretty exciting. And I didn't think it was going to fully work, but it worked more than I thought it was going to.
Yeah, I definitely thought, I did not think that was going to go off. Like, I did not think they were going to make it off of the boat, because I was thinking, like, what's the game plan? If there's one straggler, or you're not strong enough to do this or to do that. And so I was very surprised that they were able to all make it off of the boat safe and sound, at least. I don't know how they had planned to also have the cross. Because they're just on one of those like rescue boats.
Yes, the lifeboat. I mean, if I've learned anything from Titanic and yeah. what can float on a small vessel, I don't think that the like multi hundreds of pounds gold cross is going to somehow get away on the inflatable lifeboat with them. But so it's probably a good thing that they didn't end up taking it. But I had just been watching a different movie this weekend that continued to say the line, "If I can't have her, no one can." And then when Pope said that about the cross when he tries to drop it in the water, oh man, I was really hoping he was going to succeed in that. Although if he had, I assume that Ward would just get a crew out there.
Right.
Searching the depths of the ocean for it.
And what would we do for season 3?
Exactly. Right. Very good point. I would say last thing to point out for me was on episode 6, it was in memory of Carol Sutton, who was Meemaw in that episode. Yes. It turns out she passed away December 2020 from complications from COVID. And so that was a very real update, basically, at the end of that episode.
She did play a very important role in this season, especially in Pope's plotline and revealing his relationship with Denmark Tanny.
Yeah.
Anything else from season 2?
Did you guys like John B. as a character? I know we've kind of talked all around him, but just as a character.
You know, it's interesting because normally, and in the first season, I think he was far and away the main character, but in this season I was so much more interested in so many other people's stories that he really didn't want, especially once he returned home and his name was cleared, he didn't actually really do a whole lot for the rest of the season. It's kind of mostly there. Gets attacked by a gator, he's just kind of a supportive friend toward everyone else. Sarah had mentioned at the beginning of the podcast about books and other movies and TV shows trying to deal with the problem of how do we have a teen or children-centered adventure story when we've got all these structures of parents. And throughout the first 2 seasons, John B. doesn't have really any supervision, anyone taking care of him or looking after him. And that continues in this season. And he's really seen as like the guy with nothing to lose. And so he doesn't really have any reason not to just go along with everyone else's plans. And that kind of frees him up to do some dangerous things throughout the season. But I find him likable, if kind of just unremarkable for the most part, but you know.
Yeah, he really grinds my gears sometimes with the decisions that he makes. And I really like that Sarah was calling him out a bit more in season 2, of just like, he was just say like, oh no, we'll figure it out. And she's like, no, we have to have a plan. We can't just go and do this, because he just wanted to go and storm her house in the Bahamas. He's like, let's just go. And she's like, no. And then when he did do it, you see the consequences of what happened. She got captured. And so he just constantly makes these decisions where he thinks there are no repercussions, and then there are, and then he has to face those. So I wonder, I know we're about to dive into what we're thinking for season 3. I just wonder if we're going to see a little bit more growth from him, because I think he's one of those characters that I've actually seen the least growth from, because he's pretty similar to how he was in season 1.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, of all the people that we've talked about, he really hasn't changed that much. And I do like that moment where Sarah just declares, I'm in charge now, because he lied to her. She calls him on it, as you say. And then there's one point she says, I'm in charge. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yes, absolutely. He does get a little bit sort of droopy, wide-eyed teenager in love without much action behind it. But I think once the plot turns to Pope's searching, being the plot driver, then he's sort of on board with that, and Pope is the main focus there, I think.
Okay, let's go ahead and talk about season 3 and some of our predictions there, because that leads more into what we think might happen with John B. character. So I heard a friend talking today about how she thought that there had been some theories out there that maybe what we see in the final scene with Carla and John, Big John, is that this was a flashback or basically some sort of reasoning behind why he might not be alive, which I don't believe, just because the person who answers the door for Carla announces that Big John is half dead, and then he appears to be holding some sort of shroud of some kind around him, as if that might be what's keeping him alive, potentially, something like that. Mm-hmm. So I don't subscribe to that. I think that having Big John back in the picture will likely steer the story a little bit more back back around to John B.
Yeah.
Although I'm not exactly sure what was the implication behind Big John saying that he will make some sort of deal with Carla in order to help his son. Does he think his son is still on the run? Does he think his son is still charged for murder? I'm not exactly sure when or where this takes place.
Yeah, he also looks older than the flashbacks that we'd seen throughout season one and season two. And that's something we haven't mentioned, that John B. sometimes has a memory of something nice with his father. We also see the fight with Ward. So we've seen him, and now he does actually look older, even though it's only 9 months later, let's think. But he certainly looks, you know, shrunken and a bit grayed and rather unwell. So I think this is the present day Big John being visited by Carla Limbry.
Other things about season three, we saw that at the end of season two, Rafe is going to have the opportunity to shoot at any of the Pogues leaving on the boat or potentially the boat itself. And he chooses not to. And then he goes and speaks with his father and tells him that he's going to get Sarah back. Mm-hmm. Now, whether this be because they need to take care of that loose end with Sarah knowing that they are alive and escaping and have the cross, etc., or if this is more because he believes that his father's not going to be completely happy and satisfied until the entire family is reunited, despite the fact that he just tried to kill his daughter. Not 100% sure. Either way, not looking forward to it because I just can't stand Rafe, but I'm very impressed with the actor for... I need to watch like an interview or something with him to just verify that he's not this horrible person.
Yeah, like a cleanse or something. Yeah, I need something to purify him in my eyes, because otherwise he's just Rafe. I think because he did say that to Ward, that he was going to get Sarah back, I think that may be why he didn't shoot, because he wasn't sure that he wasn't going to shoot Sarah. And so, like, if he took that shot, it was a very real possibility he could have taken Sarah out, and then he would see, okay, Ward's not going to be, he's not ever going to be as happy because of that, because Sarah's gone. But I also know how jealous Rafe is of their relationship, even though Ward has come out and said now, like, okay, I choose you, Rafe. It's like, okay, is that believable? I don't think so. Not if Sarah's back in the picture and willing to talk to her dad. So I think that, like, what is Rafe's hidden agenda?
To be the favorite, I think you're right. He wants to get Sarah back to please his father, but he still wants to be the favored one. I think he's probably spiraling. I think we might see the end of Rafe during season three. You two will be pleased. I'll be sad, I think. But I think the driver, we might see more of Rafe, so get used to him. I think the Cleo, obviously we have her back now, thank goodness, so she's going to have a larger role. And I think the other person who's going to come to the fore more is Key, who, I mean, I like this actress very much, and she does a lot with not that much. But I did hint that I had a thought. So if her mother, Key's mother, got pregnant to a Pogue who isn't her father, I think that Pogue is JJ's father, because when JJ drives his father to escape, he's escaped from prison, he finds his father, he gives him money, he gives him supplies, and he drives him to steal a boat, yet another stolen boat, and he's going to drive out of the Outer Banks and presumably out of the story. JJ's father and Key are alone in the car, and JJ's father says to her, "Tell your mother I said hello."
Yeah, that is a good point, because JJ's also the only Pogue that Key did not kiss or have any type of like interaction or any level of like intimacy that would be inappropriate for someone who's related. So that is a good point. But the character, I mean, he appears to be half either Black or half Hispanic, and isn't her mom white?
Yeah, that was the point I was going to make. like, I agree with everything you just said, Sarah, in terms of the dialogue that was said. And I definitely was picking up on all of that as well. But when they show Kiara's parents, and I think that was part of the reason why I was a little bit assuming that her parents in the show were her biological parents, was because that seemed to, I don't know, I guess make sense to me racially. But I'm not 100% sure on all of this, because I'm still partly wondering if maybe could they be referring to a different pregnancy that her mom had? We're assuming that it is her pregnancy with Kiara, but they've never been like 100% explicit when it comes to that. So I'm really not sure.
Yes. I mean, to be honest, I think if this is the case, I think it's a little bit of a retrofit. Mm-hmm. They've decided throughout season two and looking mm-hmm. into plotting season three that this might be the case. So they've had to, again, in the same way that we've never seen P4L before season two, we've never heard this story of, oh, mum, you got pregnant to a Pogue and you're worried, I will too. I certainly think that racially she looks like her parents as we see them's daughter, but we saw them in season one. And if they've only come up with this idea now, that may be the solution there.
What if it's the opposite, where Key's mom is JJ's mom?
Ooh!
That, to me, makes a little bit more sense.
Blammo!
Right. Because, and even if Key is making this reference, like, yo, you slept with a Pogue, so it's like, does she know? If that's the case, does she know that JJ is her mom's son, you know?
Yeah.
Ooh.
If they are brother and sister, I think they don't know. I think because it would be great. The great thing in drama is to see someone realizing something or doing something for the first time. Mm-hmm. So to see them understand their sibling relationship for the first time.
Yeah.
It draws in the theme of JJ's search for family. It draws in the theme of Key feeling like there's a place that she belongs, but she doesn't know where it is. But maybe I'm just writing fan fiction.
Well, and I'm searching around online right now, and there are a lot of people who think that there is some sort of relation between Kiara's mother and JJ's father, whatever that may be. And then there's a lot of people questioning who Kiara's biological father is, because it just seems like it hasn't been stated outright, although it does say Mike Carrera here is stated as being her father on Wikipedia, but who knows? You know,
right.
We're digging in here.
It's just that JJ's father, I mean, even if it's not that, and even if it was just simply a liaison, JJ's father says it very suggestively.
Oh,
tell
yes.
Tell your mother I said hello.
Sure.
It's very, very suggestive. Yeah.
Yes, I definitely agree with that. Now, in general about season three, this may be an unpopular opinion. Look, I love the show. I hope season three is the last season, and I hope they tie everything up.
Me too.
Totally agree. Yes.
Because I can understand the desire to just continue for as long as you want, but as we've seen with many other shows, Riverdale, sometimes it's nice if you just sort of tie everything up, because you don't need to just keep coming up with more and more plots. I think we need to see something wrapped up in the Gold and Cross plot line. It can't just continue to exchange hands every season with no end in sight. There needs to be a solid end, and I really think if they're going to end those plot lines, we need to end the Ward and or Rafe situation with either prison, death. I can't imagine either one of them having like a drastic turnaround. We haven't talked about Rose at length, but she is also clearly someone who's, while seemingly less violent and more level-headed than either Ward or Rafe, still not a great person. I would like Wheezy to get out of that family and please grow up to be a good person. She is not given anywhere near enough credit by Sarah, who is constantly relying on her for help. So I would like to see that. And then, of course, it's going to be very interesting to see what does happen with Sarah if her entire family and life has really been stripped away from her. I think that could be interesting if Topper has to sort of help out and take her in some way, as he sort of did throughout this season. If John B's father comes back, despite everything we just talked about, I hope we never see Luke again. son for JJ's sake, and I hope that he finds some sort of guardian somewhere. So
yes,
I would like a lot of these situations to get wrapped up. That would be great.
Did we ever find out how old Cleo was?
I'm not sure.
The actress is 29, but I think she's supposed to be younger. She certainly looked. Are you hoping for a little romance?
Yeah, I'm thinking, especially with the way that we saw her being introduced to Pope, where fought. I was like, that's Pope's match right there. If she's like maybe 16, 17, because I mean, with the way that, you know, her life has been or how she's described it, it could be a very real possibility that she is younger and not like 19, 20.
Yeah, I was certainly reading her as a still a teen, but very street smart and very capable. But they're equal rather than, you know, being an older woman. Because I also hope for a romance between them, because they meet and they fight and she beats him and it's fabulous.
Assuming that there is no familial relation in any way. And there's also, I've seen some talk online about how people want JJ and Kiara to get together because they seem to have more chemistry and more in common. I don't necessarily think that would be a very healthy relationship for either of them. I think
correct.
That we've seen in this season that Kiara has a little bit more of a reckless side occasionally, and I don't think that that JJ's going to help that at all.
And I think somehow it's too neat as well. You know, this person with this person, everybody coupled up. We don't all have to be coupled up.
Right.
And I think that's why I like JJ, because he's kind of just, he's there. He doesn't need to be all tied up in someone else, and he can just be the friend. So, and I think that's also where the most likable John B comes out, is when he's having his friendship with JJ. So, we'll see. These teen shows, though, they really do like to couple everybody up. So
yeah,
we'll find out.
That's true. Yeah, I certainly agree with you 100%. I hope it's one more season and everything finished up by the end of it.
I agree.
And based on the title, it sounds like they're gonna, you know, nobody's at the Outer Banks right now, but they're gonna have to get back there.
Right.
We're gonna keep calling the show OBX, so we'll see. That really, I think, wraps up everything. Is there anything else that either of you want to touch on? Overall thoughts about the show, or anything else you want to talk about?
Once I was done on season two, I did miss it. I really grown to really adore these characters, even the ones that I disliked. I was still interested in their storyline, so I really enjoyed it. So I am definitely excited about season three, and I'm excited that we got to talk about it.
Yes, I would really recommend it, and I think it's a fun one to either binge or to spread out a little bit, because it can get a little bit hectic on a binge. I think there's enough there to sort of chew on intellectually, and there's enough there emotionally. It's really beautifully made. It looks great. I think what we haven't mentioned is the costume design. Costume design's fantastic. They look like they're wearing what these people would wear, but it's overlaid with these class markers between the kooks and the pokes, which is done really beautifully. So props there to the costume designers. They've done a really beautiful job, and it just everything quite carefully adds into the stories and the themes, and I really appreciate that about it. I know it's a light teen YA drama comedy, drama romance, drama mystery, but it really repays, you know, a careful watch, and just remember being 16 and go into it with those eyes.
Yeah, speaking of comedy, I loved when they went to see the doctor and he said, "Is it her head? Because I don't do heads."
Yeah, there's for the amount of chase scenes and shootouts in the show, and there and death, there's quite a lot of comedy as well, which is fun. I agree about the costume design. I really appreciated that in the first season they did not shy away from showing that kids in the summer living on an island where the power has gone out are going to be sweaty and dirty and gross. And then in this season, when John B and Sarah for the first four episodes are wearing the exact same clothes that then become covered in blood as well, I was like, okay, somebody get these people some new clothes, please. because I just can't stand to watch this any longer. But the costume design is great, especially when you look at someone like Kiara, who tries to wear similar clothes, but with an obvious element of money behind it. And that's something that I think it would be interesting to explore with her character more in the next season as well. But overall, love the show. Very fun to watch the first time around. Still worth it on a rewatch if you are a rewatcher. I am excited to, in the next year, assuming it's going to take that long before season three, slowly rewatch the first two seasons again. And I love this world that we have moved into in the past several years of TV shows that are allowed to be 10 episode seasons. We don't need to go farther than that. Sometimes when you try to stick to the 22 episode format, it just, that's when you get into why are we even doing this anymore? What are these plots? What's happening?
And I even like that the episodes kind of vary between like 40 minutes to maybe 55 minutes. They were all, it's not like you have to commit a full hour for each and every episode. Some are shorter than others. Some are a little bit longer. And so it felt like a good balance, especially for a binge.
Try to watch this show and really look out for the acting chops on all of these young people, especially. Really impressive. Okay, well, thank you both for joining me and talking about this. And thank you all for listening to us just gush about a show that we are all collectively very enthralled in and impressed with. So if you have not watched it and now you are fully spoiled and interested in seeing it, definitely check it out. And if you liked it, please let us know on Twitter or any other social media what you thought of the show. Would love to hear other people's thoughts and compare them with my own, because I think that it's something I'm still going to be thinking about for a while. To be honest, I finished season two today before recording, so it's all still very fresh in my mind. Hopefully we'll get a chance to come back and talk about some more Outer Banks if they make another season. You know, Netflix has a tendency to cancel some things, but I think with the popularity of this show, we'll be okay. Make sure you check out everything else that's happening on post-show recaps and all of the other scripted content that they are covering over here. You can follow me everywhere at Frail Mary to check out everything else I'm talking about, primarily Big Brother at the moment, but also some other fun things like Twilight and Riverdale on my own podcast, Kowski Cast. Asia, where can people check you out?
You can find me on Twitter at Asia Like Asia, so A-Y-S-H-A like A-S-I-A. I also help out with the Big Brother coverage this season, and then I co-host a podcast about this show called Married at First Sight. So you can catch that on the reality TV Rehap Ups. It's a show about people that actually meet each other at the altar. We had the pleasure of having Sarah Carradine on the recap of episode two. So, you know, last week, but whenever you're listening to this, season 13, episode two that we covered. So it was really awesome having Sarah on.
And Sarah, where can everyone follow you?
Well, thanks, Aisha. Yes, I was going to say I was very lucky to be a guest on episode two, and I hope to come back later and see how many of my predictions were right and how many are in the toilet. It's already changing as the season goes on.
Right.
people can follow me on Twitter at Sarah Carradine, and if we ever get out of lockdown, you can come down to Bondi Beach and I'll take you for an ocean swim.
Perfect. Well, thank you both for talking with me, and until the next mystery, P4L.